It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us for what is the biggest film release week of the year. It coincides with Christmas because, of course, there's so many people available to see movies over the holiday period, but it's also that last chance to qualify for Oscar consideration for many of the bigger budget, more prestige films that the studios put out. Joining me this week are critics who get the fortunate task of talking about the heavy hitters, Christy Lemire of YouTube's What the Flick, which she co-hosts, also critic for RogerEbert.com, and Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com. We begin with Steven Spielberg's directing of The Post. It's written by Liz Hanna and Josh Singer, stars Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, playing The Washington Post's Catherine Graham and the editor of The Post, Ben Bradley. The movie's rated PG-13. Tim, please start us with The Post.
Yeah, well, I like this movie very much. This is a Steven Spielberg film, in the best sense of that phrase. I like Steven Spielberg. I'm a Lincoln guy.
But I love Lincoln.
You know, but not every single one. Not a big Bridge of Spies or War Horse. I mean, I have 10, don't need. But generally speaking, like Steven Spielberg. And when he's doing this kind of work, that's when I love Steven Spielberg. The Pentagon Papers, right, 1971. The United States-Vietnam Relations, 1945 to 1967, a study prepared by the Defense Department. That's what the Pentagon Papers were actually called. They were never called the Pentagon Papers. This movie makes sure that you know that. That's how meticulous this movie is. He's walking through a history here, hewing as closely as he possibly can, these filmmakers, all of these people, to the things that actually happen on the day that they happen, if they can. Words that are said, whenever it is known what words were said or the words that are spoken in this movie, we hear those tapes in this movie, the actual tapes in this movie. So he's very, very concerned with telling us things. I fancy myself a person who actually knows this history fairly well. I used to teach seventh grade civics. We were just talking about that. There are moments in this movie, information in this movie, where I keep saying, I did not know that. I did not know that. That's hard to do when you're walking through a history very meticulously, while at the same time, this movie is very much concerned with speaking to the what Catherine Graham had to go through when she was dealing with all of these men. I mean, given what we are dealing with today in society, watching what Meryl Streep portrays as she's playing Catherine Graham, it's very, very interesting to move. I know it's a very traditional film, but I got to tell
that's not necessarily a bad thing.
That's what I love the most about it, in that John Williams score. Oh, yeah. So I'm very, very up on this very traditional, very well-made Steven Spielberg film.
The Post we're talking about. Christy.
It's very solidly made. Yeah, just unimpeachable in every way from a technical perspective. The cast is incredible, of course. You cannot go wrong when you begin with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. And it's easy to compare the Jason Robards performance as Ben Bradley in All the President's Men, right? Tom Hanks is doing a very different version of that, maybe perhaps not quite so caustic. Mm. A little softer, a little, you know.
A little Tom Hanksy.
Yeah, exactly. There's Tom Hanksiness to this. But what is so lovely is, you know, the greatness of Meryl Streep, that she is able to surprise you still to this day, decades later, with the nuance that she will find in a role, in a moment. And this is incredibly relevant, not only because of the kind of pressure that the White House is putting on the press currently, but also because of the way in which women are finding their voice in the workplace. And the moment that Meryl Streep, as Catherine Graham, finally stands up to all the middle-aged men who've been mansplaining things to her for her entire life, it's so exquisite. It's so subtle. It's not a giant triumphant moment, but just the quiet way in which she finally asserts herself is so powerful. It's like you want to cheer for her. Yeah, this is so well made. And so you have Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep, but also the supporting roles all down the line. There's a really cool Mr. Show reunion here between David Cross and Bob Odenkirk. And Spielberg makes sure that he gets them in the frame at the same time. So and Bruce Greenwood as Robert McNamara is excellent. Yeah, it's very of its time. It's very period specific. And perfectly so, but could not be more relevant to what's happening today.
Well, and Tim, you're talking about that the dialogue rings so true. Mm. And that's something that I'm very fussy about and kind of bothers me when you hear dialogue that sounds so
cleverly scripted, but not real. And I wonder, Christy, did you feel like the dialogue was, it felt real to you?
Well, wait till we get to Molly's game and we could talk about Aaron Sorkin. And
I didn't want to name names, but I was kind of getting ahead of myself.
Yeah. No, you know, it does feel true. It does. There's an urgency to it, but also at the same time, this is a Spielberg film, as Tim says, in the best possible way. And that means there's some corniness to it. There are some like unabashedly feel good moments that in the newsroom that Spielberg can just pull off, and we're going to go with it because it's just so well done.
And they probably were feel-good movements in the real time
they
that they
probably were.
But one would have to imagine. And then there's the production design of this film. So like this film, it's 1971. Big, gigantic set pieces. I'm looking all over the screen for things that are incorrect, and there aren't any. I mean the cars. You know what I mean? All that kind of stuff. Licenses. There aren't any.
Because you can usually find something if you look hard. You
could run this film right alongside that Sidney Pollack film, All the President's Men, Double Bill. And I promise you, if you didn't know, you would not know that one of them was made 45 years after the other one. Because that's a contemporary film, so it looks the way it looks because that's the way
it looks.
It sounds
like a Double Bill at the New Beverly that Quentin Tarantino could program. We're talking about Steven Spielberg's The Post, written by Liz Hannah and Josh Singer. Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks starred, and you've heard about some of the other members of the cast. Sarah Paulson, Alison Brie also co-star. The movie's rated PG-13. And The Frame's John Horn moderated a Q&A with a number of the people involved in the film, including Steven Spielberg, Tom Hanks, producer Amy Pascal. You can hear that conversation led by The Frame's John Horn at kpecc.org/theframe. The Post, by the way, is in wide release across the country. Paul Thomas Anderson's new film, which he's written and directed, is Phantom Thread, set in 1950s London. The drama stars Daniel Day-Lewis and Vicky Krapes. Christy?
I love this movie so much. I cannot even begin to like gush through the microphone enough to all you guys about how exquisite this movie is. Number two on my top 10 list of the year, but a very, very close number two behind Call Me By Your Name. I loved it. So this is 10 years after There'll Be Blood. We have Daniel Day-Lewis reteaming with Paul Thomas Anderson. And it's a very, very different film for Paul Thomas Anderson. It does not take place in California. It takes place in London in the 50s, and Day-Lewis plays a dressmaker, this couture dressmaker to royalty and aristocracy and socialites. And his life is meticulous, and everything is just so. And his sister, played by Leslie Manville, who is great, is his partner in the house, this house of Woodcock, the couturier. And everything's fine. And then he meets a waitress. And he initially brings her into his world as sort of a muse because she's built exactly like he wants the women wearing his dresses to be built. And you think she's just going to be this passive kind of observer in his world. And she slowly but surely just takes over in ways that are darkly funny, surprisingly. Like, this is a comedy. It looks like a very pristine and genteel kind of Merchant Ivory thing, but it's not. It's got a nutty streak to it that just sneaks up on you and builds. The score from Johnny Greenwood, who does so many of PTA's films.
It's beautiful. That score.
Yes, it's gorgeous. And it's our winner, our LA Film Critics Association winner for best use of music this year. And the dresses are amazing. And Anderson shot this. He's not credited as cinematographer, but he is so beautiful. And production-wise, every detail is perfect. I loved it.
Oh, all of the arts and crafts of cinema being brought to bear here is just so exquisitely. And necessarily so, because the world that we're in this sort of world of haute couture where everything is meant to be meticulous anyway. Not only is the filmmaking meticulous, the things that we are looking at being filmed are meticulous. All these dresses and Daniel Day-Lewis's hair, watching him trim his nose hair was quite an experience because this guy, he was real serious about that. And there you have it, right? All of these allusions to Merchant Ivory, and it really is beautiful, remains of the day, all of that kind of thing. And I'm loving it. I'm just like you. I'm loving it. And then this movie, it changes genres on you rather suddenly. You're in like a
Merchant
Ivory
film. And I hear
but it changes genres on you. And I got to tell you, I was thoroughly enjoying Merchant Ivory film. Didn't need the new genre. Okay, I dealt with the new genre. Wrote it out. Then it changed genres again. And I got to tell you, that third genre change, it's kind of a John Waters film at a certain point. And I'm like, okay. And I hear it. I feel all the love and admiration for this. And I really do love original screenplays, original screenplay here. But, man, P.T. does that sometimes. If you go back across that history of his, you'll be walking down. You're in a movie, in a certain movie. And then before you know it, you're just in a completely different movie. And if it's okay with you, it's okay with you. I like the first movie better.
But there's a subtlety that the way that it builds toward that different kind of movie. And he does that also in The Master. He does it in There Will Be Blood.
Oh, yeah.
There's a darkness and kind of an insanity that creeps up in both of those. And he does that so skillfully here as well.
The movie is Phantom Thread. Daniel Day-Lewis in what is supposedly his last screen performance. He's retiring?
Yeah, supposedly.
All right.
I hope it's not true.
Vicky Krapes co-stars. It's written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. It's rated R, and you can see it opening Christmas Day at the Landmark Theater in West Los Angeles. I also want to correct what I said about where you can see Steven Spielberg's film, The Post. It's opening in selected theaters as part of its Oscar qualifying run before it goes wide. So you can see The Post starting at the ArcLight in Hollywood, the ArcLight in Sherman Oaks, and the Landmark Theater in West Los Angeles. Later on in coming weeks, it'll go wide. Also out this week is Molly's Game from writer-director Aaron Sorkin. It's based on Molly Bloom, the Olympic skier's memoir. It stars Jessica Chastain, Idris Elba, Kevin Costner, and Michael Cera. The movie's rated R. Tim?
So we talked about a Steven Spielberg film. This is an Aaron Sorkin film, which has a definitively different sort of air than a Steven Spielberg film, particularly when we're talking about the writing and the way this dialogue is delivered. It's very Aaron Sorkin-y. People don't really talk on Earth the way people talk in Aaron Sorkin productions, which is it's fine. It's very particular. We can say the same thing about David Mamet. Or a few other writers.
Yeah, because the style there is part of the thing.
And I think that's what's going on here at this point with Aaron Sorkin. He's going to do this thing the way he does it, and his actors are going to deliver it the way he wants them to deliver it. And it's that thing that's all quick, very sharp, plus the editing of this film, which is about loosely based on the story of Molly Bloom, a world championship skier, had an accident, wasn't able to ski anymore, changed her life, became a cocktail waitress, and then fell into the sort of like gambling, Hollywood gambling. This all actually happened, right? A whole story about that. Very, very important actors, movie stars, spending millions of dollars, losing and winning millions of dollars in these undercover poker games, and what all happens. This involves her getting, almost indicted. I guess she did get indicted.
She gets arrested.
She gets arrested.
The FBI scoops her up in the middle of the night.
Yeah. And she gets a lawyer, Idris Elba, and her father, played by Kevin Costner, an excellent, excellent performance by Kevin Costner. He gets better and better and better. I really love it when that happens. He's given some really great things to say in this movie with not a whole lot to do. And Jessica Chastain, just eating this Aaron Sorkin dialogue up. She's just eating
it. Actors love the Sorkin. They love Sorkin's dialogue.
You put her and Idris Elba in a room, and a lot of this is her and Idris Elba in a room, and they're going back and forth, and it's like watching a play. It's just sharp, and it's really, really good. And I like the storyline. I knew the story, and it's pretty neat. I don't know why they allude to who these actors and stuff were. We know who they were.
Well, the Michael Cera character, the actor, is supposedly Tobey Maguire.
Well, there's right? Toby, and there was Leo, and there was Ben Affleck. These were the actors who were involved in that game. This is stuff we know, but they sort of play around with it in the movie. Yeah.
There's a reference to the Cobra Lounge is where these games take place, which is clearly the Viper Room.
The Viper Room, which is where they were played. So anyway, I like this quite a lot.
I liked it quite a lot for a long time, too. Yes, and the hose is on full blast here with Sorkin, and if for 2+ hours. And if you like him, and if you're willing to give yourself over to the heightened nature of the dialogue and of this world, you're going to love it. It is relentless, and it's a lot of fun. And it also reminded me quite a bit of The Big Short in the way Sorkin's pretty straightforward in the way he shoots this most of the time, but sometimes he'll play with like graphics and photos and just like showing you complicated information in a way that is, you know, fun and playful.
We'll continue our review of Molly's Game from writer-director Aaron Sorkin, starring Jessica Chastain and Idris Elba. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Very happy holidays from all of us at 89.3. And over this Christmas weekend, so many big films are opening up. Our Film Week critics Tim Cogshell and Christy Lemire are telling them all about us. We're right in the middle of a review of the new Aaron Sorkin written and directed movie Molly's Game, starring Jessica Chastain, Idris Elba, Kevin Costner, and Michael Cera. This is Sorkin's directorial debut too, right?
It is. And again, he's pretty straightforward with it for a lot of the time, but, you know, Aaron Sorkin, the director, really loves Aaron Sorkin, the writer. And so there's not a whole lot of restraint.
As you'd expect.
Right, as well he should. And so, you know, he's had these great actors here who do so beautifully with his very complicated, you need dexterity to do this material. And Jessica Chastain has shown us in movies like Zero Dark Thirty and like Miss Sloan that she's really up for the challenge. You mentioned Kevin Costner and how much you liked him. I think he's in the weakest scene in the movie. There's a point, unfortunately, where the men in her life try to mansplain her to herself, right? So Idris Elba, as her lawyer, does this. Mm-hmm. And then Kevin Costner, in a totally contrived scene, he just shows up literally out of nowhere to have a talk with her on a park bench. And it makes her nice and sympathetic in ways that I wish she didn't need to be. I wish she could have stayed complicated and a little messy despite, you know, being perfectly coiffed at all times. I kind of liked that she was a flawed character, and the movie tries to make her nice in that one Kevin Costner.
One of the things that I like most about the movie, because all that mansplaining for sure, but Molly, you know, I mean, or the character in the film, she cuts these guys to pieces. That's what I, including her dad. I mean, you know, Kevin Costner's playing her dad. And yeah, they're coming at her like that, particularly, you know, with the poker games and all, you know, the men acting like men do in places like that. And the other thing that I liked about it is she knew she was beautiful and she knew she could break a guy in half just with that. And she was not afraid to use it. So I liked that she brought to bear all of her tools to bring these men to heel. And she brings even her dad to heel, I think. But, you know, I don't know. You tell me. Yeah.
that scene just kind of it's going for redemption and catharsis. And it made the whole movie kind of grind to a halt for me. But, you know, it's a great supporting cast. Besides that, Michael Cera is in an unusual villain role here. And then Bill Camp is one poker player who has like this very tumultuous couple of days in her high-end poker suite at the hotel. So, yeah, it's a good cast. It bodes well for Sorkin to direct more. But, again, if you like him, I think you got to like him to get into this.
Yeah, you got to be into it to be into it. Yeah,
does the real Molly Bloom make a cameo, do you know, in the film?
I don't think so.
No?
But she was on the red carpet with Jessica Chastain for the premiere. So she's out and about in the world again.
Endorsing it, clearly. Molly's Game is based on Bloom's memoir, the film written and directed by Aaron Sorkin. It's rated R, and it's opening in selected theaters over the course of the holiday weekend. So some locations it'll be opening on Christmas Eve, others it'll open on Christmas Day. So check your local listing. Selected theaters for Aaron Sorkin's Molly's Game. It's rated R. All the Money in the World takes us back to the kidnapping of 16-year-old John Paul Getty III. Mark Wahlberg, Michelle Williams, Charlie Plummer, and Christopher Plummer star in the Ridley Scott-directed film. David Scarpa wrote the screenplay, adapting it from the book by John Pearson. Christy?
So similar to The Post and Molly's Game, this is a movie based on a true story. And this is famous in ways that go beyond the actual story at this point, because Ridley Scott chose to recast Kevin Spacey as John Paul Getty. And Kevin Spacey had done it. The movie was done. And he'd done it all in the prosthetic makeup to look older. And then all these allegations came out against Kevin Spacey. And so with about 6 weeks to go before opening day, Ridley Scott chose to recast him and reshoot it and put Christopher Plummer into that role, which is who he wanted originally anyway.
And whose age is closer to where John Paul Getty was.
Yes. And so it's really seamless, because Ridley Scott is such a technical master that I think if you didn't know all that, you would go into this not realizing anything was amiss. And Plummer is just chilling, again, as a really complicated guy and not necessarily a nice guy. And the way he handles his grandson's kidnapping, although it's his prized favorite grandson, he does not in any way react the way you think a kindly grandfather might. And so Michelle Williams is the kid's mom. She's excellent in this. it is more than just the put-upon wife and mom role that she is sadly so often relegated to. And Mark Wahlberg
including this week.
Including this week in the next movie we're going to talk about. Actually, good tease there, Tim. Thank you. So, yeah, and Mark Wahlberg is the former CIA operative who helps her track him down in Italy. And it's slick, and it's tense, and it's well-made and beautifully shot. Darius Volsky is the cinematographer, and it's just gorgeous. And really, you would never know that they did massive. I mean, really a lot of reshoots. He's in this movie a lot.
Yeah. And obviously juxtaposed to the other characters, Michelle and Mark Wahlberg and everything. So they had to come back and do that. And they had to look the same. All that's going on. Interestingly, this movie, Ridley Scott, is at the exact opposite thing that Steven Spielberg et al. Were at in The Post. About the only thing that's true in this movie is that John Paul Getty got kidnapped in 1971.
In Italy.
And pretty much everything else in this movie is made up. Almost whole cloth made up. Things that people did.
So
where
is
he
it
was
plausible,
held.
Despite the fact that the events are completely dramatized?
It makes for a very good thriller, kidnap thriller. That could have been made with all of these people and been called this and give them all different names, and it would have been just a pretty good thriller. But it doesn't have just about anything whatsoever to do with the Old Man Getty. Whose name was Gene, actually, Jean Paul Getty, the old man Getty. They're really complicated because there's the middle Getty, his son, whose name was Eugene, and then, of course, the young Getty, the third.
The third.
And
yeah.
These people, you know what's interesting, Larry, and I know that you know this, is that everything that happened after this kidnapping, the ensuing 20 years, that's the interesting Getty story, the misery that this kidnapping wrought on that family. So this is a perfectly lovely, serviceable thriller, but you won't come away from this knowing anything about the Getty kidnapping because it's not in this movie.
Yes, they allude to him beginning to develop the Getty Villa in Malibu.
Yeah.
And so that kind of brings it up to the current day, but it's it's well made.
Yeah, it's a good kidnap thriller. It just doesn't have anything to do with the Gettys actually.
And it sounds like a great performance by Christopher Plummer.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, he's chilling.
All the Money in the World, starring Mark Wahlberg, Michelle Williams, Charlie Plummer, and Christopher Plummer. Ridley Scott directed. David Scarpa wrote the screenplay. It's rated R, and it opens Christmas Day in wide release. The Greatest Showman is open in theaters right now. It takes us back to the days of P.T. Barnum and The Greatest Show on Earth. Hugh Jackman stars as Barnum. Michelle Williams, Zac Efron, Rebecca Ferguson, and Zendaya are in the cast. Michael Gracie directs from a screenplay written by Jenny Bix and Bill Condon. Christy?
This is an incredibly empty, glossy look at P.T. Barnum. This is a very sanitized look at him. It makes him out to be this wonderful, visionary guy who just wanted to be inclusive of people who had lived on the fringes and been disenfranchised their whole lives. And nowhere in here is the sucker-born-every-minute Barnum. And it's a musical, and it's a musical kind of like Moulin Rouge in that it takes place in the 1800s, but it has... Or early 1900s?
That Victorian period.
It's a big span of time. But the songs are extremely contemporary pop songs, big bombastic ballads, and they are all essentially saying the same thing over and over again. You know, it's okay to be different. You know, here, shout your voice and be heard and find your identity, and that's awesome. And every single song is so repetitive. The Zac Efron and Zendaya number is the only one that deviates from that. They have a romance, an interracial romance that is barely developed at all. But at least that number is pretty cool because they use the space in the circus in innovative ways. They are singing in the trapezes and in the ropes and in the rafters, and it's really cool. And it's cool to see Zac Efron sing and dance again. Yeah, the songs are okay. The songs are written by the La La Land songwriters.
They're okay.
It's the connective tissue in between that is ridiculous and flimsy.
Yeah, there were a couple of big songs that actually got to me that I really loved, including that one. Zendaya, I thought was actually quite good.
She's very good.
She's very charismatic. She has this face that, you know, when the camera, her in a 50mm lens, forget about it. And that sort of thing, these sort of big set pieces and all of this. But, you know, this movie does not really understand what P.T. Barnum was up to. And the nature of him. That's a darker story, and it alludes to that, how he would promote these people, quote-unquote, freaks, and say these things about them and want to integrate them into society, but he actually stayed away from them and kept them away, and he was really just trying to work his way up a particular ladder of society. And I don't know, that's a more interesting story to me, would have been a more interesting story.
The more complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of P.T. Barnum is a reflection of America's psychology,
exactly.
And of his own demons.
So I missed the story that I think that they missed.
Right. Well, they turned him into this charismatic, plucky climber. And the worst thing he does is he has such celebrity of his own that he neglects his wife, played by Michelle Williams.
Now, that's the thankless role.
There you go. And the two daughters, also really fast, the age disparity between them is so distracting because the characters meet as children and they're the exact same age. And then they become Hugh Jackman and Michelle Williams,
yeah.
And they are 15 years apart.
Yeah, and that's
distracting
crazy
the whole time.
Yeah.
The Greatest Showman, the biographical musical starring Hugh Jackman and Michelle Williams. Michael Gracie directs. The Greatest Showman is rated PG, and it's open right now in wide release. Pitch Perfect 3, as the title suggests, third in that series about the young a cappella singers Anna Kendrick, Brittany Snow, Rebel Wilson, Anna Camp star Trish C. is the director, and Kay Cannon and Mike White are the screenwriters here. Tim?
Trish directed Step Up All In, like a third or fourth installment in the Step Up movies. And I like the Step Up movies, and hers was really, really good. So I see why she's here. I've had the good fortune of being able to talk about all three of these movies on the show. I'm nuts about these movies. As ridiculous as they are. The first one was about the girls versus the boys, basically. The boys are all gone by the time you get to this movie. It's just the girls. The second one was this big international competition that they were engaged in. You had these Germans and all that kind of stuff. And this one is just about them as they sort of push off into their lives as adults, and they want to get together one more time. One of the characters' father is in the military, so she gets them insinuated into this USO show. And they're out on this USO tour with all of these, with the bands, with music, and all this hip. And I got to tell you, these people can sing, man. They can sing and they can dance, and they're just wonderful. I don't really actually remember what this movie is about.
But that's not the point.
It's
right.
Just not
it's about the
point.
Songs, yeah. Right. So the one thing this has going for it is that it's not a complete retread like Pitch Perfect 2 was. They have thrown all semblance of realism out the window, and this becomes this crazy, over-the-top James Bond-style action picture. I'm not saying that's better. I'm just saying it's at least different, and that's good. John Lithgow is in here, and he does this intentionally terrible Australian accent.
Oh, is that an Australian accent?
I guess
it was bad.
Well, Rebel Wilson's Australian. Anyway, you have John Michael Higgins and Elizabeth Banks kind of wedged in here again. It's okay. If you like the other ones, you'll like this, I guess.
Well, and it's funny because, as you mentioned, the first two, sort of like the formula that they – but it sounds like this is a little different in the terms of the formula.
I mean, the formula still exists in that it's just a bunch of nonsense to get to the songs. But at least they have a little bit of fun. There's an exploding yacht in it, so that's different.
And then they sing. They sing.
And then they cry at the end because it's the last time.
Oh, I love
How
this.
Do you know it will really be the last time if this right. takes off at the box office?
Well, the first two made $400 million worldwide, so hence we have a third.
Yeah. 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 Who knows? These now young women may be back in their 70s for Pitch Perfect 42. You never know. Pitch Perfect 3, directed by Trish C. Kay Cannon and Mike White are the screenwriters. It's rated PG-13 and in wide release. Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. We'll hear about that coming up, as well as the dramatic comedy from Alexander Payne, Downsizing with Matt Damon. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Back after this update. Pleasure to have you with us on Film Week, and I just want to make note, if you joined us late, this is the biggest week of the year for major film releases. It's both Oscar qualifying as well as so many of the big budget films looking for that big Christmas audience that's available over the holiday vacation. So if you joined us late, please visit kpcc.org, where you can hear the entirety of the program on our stream, or you can listen to the podcast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our critics this week are Christy Lemire and Tim Cogshell. And next up, Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson, Kevin Hart, Karen Gillian, and Jack Black. Jake Kasdan is the director, and there are four credited screenwriters. Christy.
So this is a sequel of sorts to the 1995 family action comedy Jumanji starring Robin Williams, but it's really different. And so this time you have four high school students who are all very different who get stuck in detention together. And it, so it sounds a little bit like The Breakfast Club in the beginning. You have a nerd and a jock and a mean girl and a reclusive girl. And in their chores they're forced to do, they find this old video game, like 1990s era, like cartridge video game called Jumanji. And they play it. And then they get sucked into it. And it becomes this really cool and surprisingly funny body swap comedy because these people who were stuck in their roles in the real world become totally different people in the video game. And so the nerd goes into Dwayne Johnson's body and the mean girl goes into Jack Black's body. And it's really fun. They have such a great time playing with the inherent contradictions between what they look like and what they feel like. And it moves really well. I was shocked at how good this is. I don't really play a lot of video games, but they have a good time with a self-awareness of the video game structure in that there are certain kinds of power-ups and you get a certain number of lives and there are characters whose sole purpose is to show up and explain things to you and they say it over and over and over again. So yeah, I had a really good time here. I was surprised.
Cutscenes and of course the central thing of any game, one of these kind of games anyway, is that you have to work together in order to get out of the game. The conceit of the first movie, of course, was that the game came into the real world. All the animals, the digital animals. Very, very early. We were just talking about Joe Johnstone, who directed that film, The Rocketeer, and some other really great early CGI sort of films. And that was the idea in that film. This one, we go into the game. The performances are really, really good. Particularly Dwayne Johnson, who is playing a 16-year-old nerd, you know, in Dwayne Johnson's body.
That's not an easy role.
No, it's really he has these sort of mannerisms, these looks, and every time he looks at his own bicep, he gets all like, oh my God, that's insane. And it's so that's funny. Having everyone sort of go through these sort of things. And then there's a bit of heart in there, too. You know, I mean, this movie got a tear out of me.
The last scene, oh, my gosh, is surprisingly poignant, yes.
And you know what? It's not insulting. It's not mean. It's violent, but not, like, violent in that kind of violence that's sort of real. We're going to be talking about Hostel soon. Not that kind of violent. In a minute, we're going to talk about father figures, which intends to be a movie like this. But blows it for all the exact same, the reverse reasons. It's mean and it's dumb and it puts people down. So, you know, I'm thinking that PG, what is this, PG-13?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm thinking that PG-13 might be useful sometimes. It makes you be funny instead of dirty. It makes you be funny instead of mean. So, you know, the PG-13, way to go.
Yeah, and they have changes of heart that feel surprisingly earned for what looks like a silly action comedy. Yeah, and Jack Black is really great. I mean, the physical comedy of Jack Black always, but he has this
because on the inside, he's a really beautiful young blonde girl.
it's very funny.
So don't be scared off by the four screenwriters.
No, I was surprised at how good this was, yeah.
And they are Chris McKenna, Jeff Pinkner, Scott Rosenberg, and Eric Summers. They're the screenwriters. Jay Kasdan directing Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, the action comedy, is in wide release, rated PG-13. Downsizing, a comedic drama from writer-director Alexander Payne. He co-wrote the screenplay with Jim Taylor. It stars Matt Damon, Christoph Waltz, Hong Chow, and Kristen Wiig. Tim?
I love the concept, a very, very high concept film that wants to speak to some really sort of heavy ideas about humanity and society and the way we behave in society. So in fairly quick order, what we learn is that some Swedish scientists have come with a way to reduce organic matter down to, say, for a human, the size of about 5 inches, right? Now, over the course of several years, people start doing this. And the reason why they do it is because you can live way better when you're 5 inches tall on $100,000. $100,000 works out to be like $12 million when you're only 5 inches tall because you need a lot less stuff, you know. A dollhouse becomes a mansion. All right. Interesting. And then all of the sort of visual trickery that has to be done to create this world. And then the ideas come into the film. Some of which are sort of obvious. One of them being is that we kind of bring who we are and the nature of things with us no matter where we go. So society as it exists today sort of reconfigures itself almost exactly the same on a micro scale. It's a neat idea. It's a rather, I think it's like kind of like a rather obvious idea, but nevertheless, it's a neat idea. And then it gets into the sort of didactic, sort of preachy thing that it does, because, you know, nobody can tell Alexander Payne that, no, take that out.
I'm just not sure what he's preaching. You know, I'm just not sure what he is satirizing here. And that is so surprising from somebody whose targets are, his aim is usually true. You know, his satire is so sharp. I love Sideways. I love Election. I love Nebraska.
Nebraska.
Right. Excellent. I'm a big fan of his films. I really am. And this is his usual writing partner.
That's the thing in Hawaii that was problematic for a couple of reasons. Yeah.
Jim Taylor's his usual writing partner and collaborated with him on this as well. And it really goes astray. And if indeed they are satirizing the notion of, you know, striving and conspicuous consumption, yes, that's incredibly obvious. But then it meanders and goes into all these different directions. And there's a character played by Hong Chau, who is this one-legged Vietnamese dissident that Matt Damon's character gets involved with. And it is kind of an offensive stereotype of an Asian immigrant. Her accent is super over the top.
And people have been talking about that.
Yes, and she is the voice of reason, and she does sort of shake him out of his narcissism, but at the same time, like, it made me cringe. It put me on edge the whole time, and it did not work for me. Also, this movie is like 2 hours and 20 minutes long. I have no idea
which
where
is actually
it's headed.
Its biggest problem.
It's so long.
That extra 20 minutes. That thing didn't bother me, though, I must say.
The Hong Chau character?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I simply know people who talk like that.
Okay.
And I love them.
Yeah. Well, she's interviewed by the host of The Frame, John Horn. You can hear the interview, and maybe she'll talk about the accent she uses in the film. You can hear the full interview at kpcc.org/The Frame. We're talking about Alexander Payne's movie, Downsizing. He is the director and co-screenwriter with Jim Taylor. Matt Damon, Christoph Waltz, Hong Chau, and Kristen Wiig star. It's rated R in wide release. The action fantasy Bright is streaming now on Netflix. A big-budget Netflix-only, pretty much, release. Will Smith, Joel Edgerton star in the film, directed by David Ayer. Max Landis wrote the screenplay. Tim?
So this is completely and totally insane. And I love it for its insanities. David Ayer wrote U-571 and
Training Day.
Oh, yeah. And Suicide Squad was a film, his most recent film, with Will Smith, of course. And a film that he did that I think everybody likes, probably his best film, was a film called End of Watch.
Michael Peña. Love that movie.
And Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, great performance by Peña in that
beautiful
film.
Imagine that movie, yet it's set in a world where the characters of Lord of the Rings exist here in Los Angeles, right? So you got these cops, contemporaries, but all of the orcs, the elves, the fairies, all of them. 2,000 years ago, all of that happened, and it's been 2,000 years, and we live in a Los Angeles where these creatures are. Will Smith's character is paired up with an orc, played by Joel Edgerton, right? There is some mysticism and some magic stuff going on. Here's the thing. I don't really like those Lord of the Rings movies. And to my mind, all of these characters, the orcs and the elves and all that stuff, way and way better service of this completely wacky movie than they are in those movies. And this is bananas, crazy, insane. I'm telling you that right now. Magic wands.
Well, you were into it.
But I loved it all the way through. Had to back it up and watch a couple of scenes twice.
Wow. That's all that time of your life that's just gone for good. This movie is nutty bananas, and I'm usually a fan of nutty bananas, but it never works. It's an incredibly heavy-handed allegory about racism, first of all, because the orcs are discriminated against as like second-class citizens. And the effects look terrible. It's not funny. It's not thrilling. It's just weird and a horrible misfire.
All right. For Netflix subscribers, you can decide for yourself. What do you think of Bright on Netflix? Will Smith, Joel Edgerton star, David Ayer direct, Max Landis wrote the screenplay. It's unrated. A lot more movies to come on Film Week. It's Film Week on 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. So many ways to listen to our weekly program. either Friday live at 11 o'clock, Saturday at noon as part of our new KPCC lineup, or wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, and the like. You can also hear it whenever you want archived at kpcc.org. We're talking with film critics Tim Cogshell and Christy Lemire. Next up, the comedy Father Figure, starring Owen Wilson, Ed Helms, Glenn Close, Terry Bradshaw, J.K. Simmons, Christopher Walken, Ving Rhames, Cat Williams. Lawrence Schur is the director, and Justin Malin, the screenwriter. Tim?
Big old cast for such a mean, not funny, rude, obvious movie. This is the thing. So this is an R-rated adult comedy as opposed to that PG-13 we were talking about a minute ago. So in service of that R rating, this movie has to be obnoxious and rude and sort of nasty, frankly. So you got Ed Helm and Owen Wilson. They're these brothers. Their mother is Glenn Close. They've always thought that their father died when they were really young, and they find out that their father didn't die when they were. So the conceit of this movie is this: Mom, and they say this in the movie over and over and over again. This is the joke that keeps coming back up. Mom was such a big old hoe. That she has no idea who fathered us. And we go to another joke. They meet Terry Bradshaw. He might be their father.
This is all, by the way, in 30-second TV ads for the film.
It's just that's the whole thing. And that central joke, I hate. I hate that joke. I don't mind the idea of a joke about a free-spirited mom from the 60s or whenever. They would have been born, I guess it would have been the 70s, actually. That's funny. That's perfectly fine. But they couch it in these very crude terms, right? And then apologize for it as they go along. So I don't like that. Cat Williams eventually shows up in the movie, and there's a moment where they tie him up in the back of the car because they're afraid he might be a killer. And I get it. It's a joke. But, look, the two white dudes can't tie the brother up in the back of the car because they're afraid he might. You can't do that. Joke don't work anymore. Not in 2017. We're not doing that joke or any of these jokes. So these people would have been done well to give themselves a PG-13 rating. And then be actually funny.
And do something creative.
Yeah.
Father Figures is the comedy. Lawrence Schur, the director. It's rated R. It's in wide release. Happy End is Austria's official Oscar submission. Isabelle Huppert stars in the film, which is written and directed by Michael Haneke. It's rated R. Tim?
Yeah, a Michael Haneke film. If you know Michael Haneke films, then...
The audience may be in for some grueling stuff.
Yeah, this is tough, but it is quite good. It's about a family, mostly told from the point of view of the little girl. I think she's 12 or 13 years old. Her mother has just overdosed on some pills. She has to go live with her fairly estranged father and auntie. Her father's a doctor, remarried, has a baby. Her auntie is running this corporation and has an adult son who's kind of a whack job. And then there's the grandfather, played by Jean Louis. These people are all deeply, deeply miserable. And she can see this. And she records some of it with her phone. But she's very insightful. And how it affects her, this is just so, so hard.
You know what's interesting? The description of it is about how this family is wealthy and miserable and clueless as to the plight of immigrants all around them. And I didn't get that part of it at all.
That floated in from nowhere.
Yeah, I got the wealthy, miserable part. And Michael Haneke will, let us simmer in that with long takes. He really will let us, luxuriate in the uncomfortable nature of these people's conversations with each other. And the little girl is great. Fontaine Ardoin. She's amazing. And she's our conduit to this. From the very beginning, she's holding the shot with her own iPhone with long takes of what's going on with her family. And her through line is the most interesting to me. Isabelle Huppert is exquisite, as always, of course. But the girl's story to me was the one that I latched onto. And then all of a sudden, there are immigrants trotted in for this engagement party, and it's like, where are we going with this? And having said that, the absolute end is, oh my God, edge of your seat, excruciating what's going to happen. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the He's a master. The craft is totally on display, as always, but I wonder about the story he's trying to tell.
Well, it sounds like you've got to really be a Haneke fan, as always.
Yeah.
Movies, if, you know.
And him, Lars, Von Trier, there are a few. You know.
Not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, definitely not. Happy End, again, it's Austria's official submission for the Oscar foreign language category. Isabelle Huppert, Jean-Louis Trintignant star in the film, written and directed by Michael Haneke. It's rated R, and the movie is in selected theaters. Hostels, a Western that stars Christian Bale, Rosamund Pike, Wes Studi, Ben Foster, Jesse Plemons in the cast. Scott Cooper is the writer-director based on Donald E. Stewart's story. It's rated R. Christy?
So Scott Cooper makes these very self-serious, well-made, but kind of slow and kind of ponderous movies. His last one was Out of the Furnace, and now we have Hostels starring a very low-talking Christian Bale as this famous army captain who is forced to escort this Cheyenne chief and his family from New Mexico up to Montana. And it's who they encounter along the way, the brutal Comanches that they fight with, and Rosamund Pike and her, what happened to her family in the beginning, and she becomes part of their journey. And it's a revisionist Western, and so it's about how, you know, there are no good guys and there are no bad guys. Everyone is flawed and everyone is complicated, and that's admirable to depict the situation in that regard. And it's shot very beautifully, but it's incredibly slow and ponderous, and it's got an interesting cast. Like, Timothy Chalamet has a small supporting part, Jesse Plemons, Ben Foster. It's just a drag, and I couldn't wait for it to end.
It's a certain kind of Western, for sure. Very big, very long, very... Wes Studi was in Geronimo. He played the titular character in Geronimo, 1993.
Yeah, I remember that. It was a huge role for him.
Has the exact same face.
He hasn't aged at all?
The same face, literally, playing the old chief in this movie. It's a brutal, brutal movie. There are basically three kinds of American Westerns. There's the savage Indian Western, the 40s, 50s Westerns that we all grew up, what did some of us grew up watching. And then there's the revisionist Westerns, which were about the noble savage. Little Big Man
comes right to mind.
Right up through probably Dances with Wolves, I suppose. And then there's a Western now, a new sort of American Western that says, okay, we were savage, but you were too. Or you were savage, but we were too. And the best savage won. And that's about the most we can say about this. And there's something in the thought of that that's in this movie that I do appreciate. Not going to make you out to be more than you are. Not going to make me out to be more than I was. We were all awful. And this is where we are now.
The unfortunate part of that is then, you know, you put that on screen with humans behaving terribly toward each other. Where's the redemption in that?
Yeah, it's a tough thing. And that's what he looks for in this movie. And that's what he comes by, perhaps not fairly, I think.
We're talking about the Western Hostiles, written and directed by Scott Cooper, Christian Bale, Rosamund Pike, and Wes Studi star. The movie is rated R. It's at the AMC Century City Cinemas in selected theaters. I want to wish you a wonderful holiday weekend. Of course, Film Week will be with you coming up usual time next week right here on 89.3 KPCC. And also remind you that the podcast is available whenever you want a chance to listen. And we have so many movies this week for the Christmas weekend. Maybe you want to go back and listen again to one of the ones that you're considering getting a ticket for over the next week. My thanks to our critics this week, Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of YouTube's What the Flick, and Tim Cogshell, critic for All Film Guide and Cinegods.com. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us at Film Week.